This is Michael Scharf. The date is July 19th, 2012, and I'm joined by my colleague, Rick Messick, and together we're speaking with Mitch Daniels, who's the governor of Indiana. Governor, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thrilled to do it.
Here were the sort of five things I thought would be useful to hear your views on. One is the theme of off to a good start. How important is it, you know, the 100 days business, and moreover, what's the groundwork that was laid both in the campaign and the transition? Second is sort of the idea of change strategy. And although I hate this term, everyone uses it, it does seem to have some value, low-hanging fruit, you know? And then I thought one of the interesting things is the changes that without which nothing else. And, you know, you pointed out in the book how you were so glad you did the scrap the collective bargaining business in terms of what was allowed you to do later. Enlisting support would be number three, you know. And one of the things we're interested in would be, for example, the outreach to the career staff. And I saw, for example, on the day you were took office, you had a letter to every, well, you know, as you obviously realized, if 30,000 people are again yet, the little staff in the governor's office makes them, you know. Then also one thing that I saw is gathering up the reins of power, creation of the Office of Management and Budget, the executive branch staff, getting control over agency appointments and so forth. And then the last, which struck me, I know this never happens in Indiana politics, and of course it's very rare in Washington politics, was sort of the ego management business, you know. And maybe you've got a staff, of course, in the executive branch, and then you've got these agency heads, and you've got lots of ambitious, dynamic people, and, you know, how do you make them ensure they row the boat in the same direction? So those are sort of the things I thought we might hit upon, and the, you know, how important was it that off to a good start?
I assume it was very important. We don't know. But all the evidence is that both tactically and long term, it makes great sense to strike while the iron is hottest. And you know, in our case, and I'll give you some time during this conversation, a crystal clear, very large example of this. But we had a very fragile, we captured a very fragile majority in the General Assembly, which I knew could easily be reversed, and it was, at least in one house. Therefore, if we hadn't done things in the first year, or at least the second, many would not have happened at all, including some of the most important things, or wouldn't have happened for years. But just to state the obvious, someone who seeks and secures election generally experiences a period of goodwill. Of course, I tell people, I remember back then, I said, you know, the honeymoon will end on the day of the first change. And there's that. But as a general principle, we assumed that we should do as much as we could, as fast as we could. We always viewed, to use another cliche, political capital as renewable. Capital properly invested earns a return, which you can then invest in the next change and the next one. You mentioned preparation for major change. Let me just lay one predicate here. You'll know this, Rick, but every listener wouldn't. If there's one constant in the histories written about the state of Indiana or analyses of cultural state, it is that we are a conservative state, and they don't mean in the modern usage, they mean in the sense of resistance to change and slowness to change and reverence for tradition, and we like it the way it is. And so our whole reason for running, if I had to reduce it to one sentence, back in 2003 and 2004, was to try to challenge that and perhaps change that predisposition to suit a world in which, as I always said, those who tread water sink. And so there was there was an even higher premium, I thought, on successful, bold, visible action that would announce to our fellow citizens, hey, these people really meant what they said when they were campaigning, and B, there's a new day here. Now, one last word about the competition for office. This is a confession I've made before. I started in July of 2003, no name, first-time candidate. I will come and go from public life having only ever run for one job, which is, of course, not exactly the pattern. Mm-hmm. But anyway, as you mentioned, there had been a 16-year, unbroken 16-year regime of the other party. The state had sunk. The state was in financially or fiscally broke. The state government was a joke and a mess, as it is in too many places. The economy was stagnant and worse. So I said for about a month to those who were helping us, this is a keep it simple, stupid situation. We're just going to point out the obvious. State's broke, government's broken. We can do better economically. Time for a change. QED. It didn't take very long before I realized, number one, that wasn't very responsible. Number two, it wasn't really even smart, that it was going to be a better electoral strategy and certainly a better preparation for office to go ahead and figure out and elaborate clearly a program for change. And we did way past the point that any sane citizen wanted to study. And but week after week, we were making proposals of things we would do. And so I was really determined to start fast and show that that wasn't just a campaign rhetoric.
And I saw somewhere that 70 specific proposals by you.
Yeah.
By the time the campaign was over.
A little, yeah, something like that. Somewhere around here there must be one. There, the basic campaign handout by sometime in the election year was called the Roadmap. And on one side, the side people really wanted to look at, it was a map of Indiana, showed all these places that I'd been in my mm-hmm. famous RV, and mm-hmm. and where it broke down, and where we got lost, and where we got the best tenderloin sandwich, and sort of, and that was the fun side. But on the other side was the roadmap for Indiana's next era, and it, each time we printed it, it had more specifics on it. In my drawer over there, I have this shredded, tattered scorecard. When we arrived in office, I had those 70-some items printed on signs, and we went about checking them. There were three columns: yes, or achieved, partially achieved, or not achieved. Check, 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 check. And a lot, a big new crop of governors got elected in 2010. And a whole bunch of them, called up and came around, and they asked a question much like yours. And I urged them all, you got big things to do. Go hard, go early. And, just for obvious reasons. One, you have momentum, and two, you have, there's time for changes to work out. Robert Kennedy said, change always has its enemies, best way to overcome that is with tangible results. And so the sooner you get something in place, if it's a wise idea, the better. And And again, at least in a setting like ours, big and numerous actions begin to change the expectation. At that table over there, I remember the news conference right at the end of the first session, and a veteran reporter said, "Governor, you know, that was more than we've had to cover in 10 or 15 years put together. What's next?" The important question was the what's, you know, what, now he assumed there'd be more, and there was. And I had an answer for him, but it's hard for me to imagine a situation where the better course is to ease into things. I mean, there must be environments where that's the case, but ours was not
so,
one.
So you've got 70 concrete proposals the day you get elected, and I assume one of them was to rescind the executive order on collective bargaining?
Actually, no, it wasn't on the list. Hadn't decided. I detailed this in the book. Another confession. I tried to talk myself out of that. And I think I explained why. I was worried about it, about however useful we might decide it would be. I was worried about doing it because I thought it might suddenly change the subject and subvert everything else we wanted to do.
Yet, as you say in this book, a lot of the things that you accomplished, you couldn't have accomplished.
That's right.
Had you not?
That's right. Knowing what I know now,
I
would have done it, yep. And whatever the consequences, I would have decided that they were worth it. I feel very fortunate that it didn't. I think it was probably the suddenness. I don't think people expected it. Or at least expected it as sort of a lightning bolt like that, and so there was no time to raise Cain about it.
Well, and I saw the letter, which we'll want to track down the copy of the letter that went to every state employee, and I assume there was some more follow up in terms of getting these, what was then about 34,000 folks in the boat, and at least starting to row in that direction.
Well, right. I don't even generally like to go to lunch, but I went to the cafeteria, you know, a couple times a week there, at least for a while, and certainly made the rounds of agencies. I think in general, public employees get a bad rap. Most of them really want to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Too many of them are in settings that don't challenge them. You certainly don't reward them for doing a good job. You know, one of the more fundamental changes that we've made rather quietly, only because, I don't know, the news media doesn't seem interested in such things, they should be. And we're the only state in the country, to my knowledge, that pays on a performance basis, not a longevity basis. You know, grid and whatever you call it.
Bell curve.
We pay on a bell curve.
Yeah.
And we pay bonuses, spot bonuses, and we have big awards, particularly for individuals or groups who...
Adam thought that was... We talked to Adam yesterday, and he thought more than the money was the recognition.
I agree
that
with
you
that.
Gave.
It's true. I've seen that a lot of places. And, you know, you can get a couple of the programs. And it's fun. Just read the stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ones I always like, by the way, and a very important... point I try to make to others, you know, new governors, or, for instance, is that, there is low fruit. In fact, it hangs very low in government. It was amazing how much
fruit there was hanging.
Yeah, how much, how many improvements and how much money you could save, just the simplest things. However, to be able to do it, year on year on year, which has been our experience, you can look in the data and you'll see that we have, our compound rate of spending for 8 years is 1.32%, which is about half inflation. And you don't do that with someone sitting on Olympus, you know, making bold pronouncements and you don't even do it through very smart managerial changes at the departmental level, although there have been tons of those. You know, under the low fruit category, an example, I think it's in the book, it's one I commonly use. We weren't here 2 weeks when the bright young guy who's we found to head our corrections department.
Well, the food business.
Okay, so you got that one. You know, that's like falling off a log. To save, I don't know, by now probably $20 million a year compared to what we spent. Well, for better food, by the way, which is part of the story. Well, even those things, which we continue here and there to discover, aren't sufficient. What you really want to have ultimately is a culture in which everybody's looking. So when we have those for better ways or less expensive ways. And so when we have those recognitions, or when there's spot bonus, the ones I love are where somebody found a way not to save $14 million, but $14,000. You know, I don't know, some fella recently tromping around one of our parks had been asked, they said, we're going to have to put a fence around this area to protect from hikers walking through. It's a fragile wetlands or something. And the guy says, after thinking about it, he says, there's only two trails in there. Why don't we put up two signs? Now, it saved a few thousand dollars. I was more excited about that, honestly, than something with a lot more zeros attached. And we made a big fuss over that fella. That's what you ultimately want, as in
culture change.
Yeah. And I'm hoping that we've gotten there. You know, one of the regrets I had about the recession was that we had to skip a couple years of pay increases. Yeah. Every state, I mean, we weren't cutting it as some states were, but we just couldn't. And what I hated about that was I wanted to deeply embed this notion that we pay for performance in Indiana. And I hated to skip a couple of years. We'd had it for probably, let's see, we put it in place the first chance we got, the end of the first year. So it had been in place maybe 4 years, and then we have to skip a couple. Well, we got back on, we were on our feet pretty well fiscally in 2011, and the pay increases, you know, happened in December. And I did something that has never been done here. In the middle, at the end of the fiscal year last year, when we were in really strong shape, I declared, I think I called it an efficiency dividend. And out of the blue, we gave every state employee, I think it was $1,000, you have to go look, to reward them for their central role in improving Indiana state government and helping us stay in the black when everybody else was drowning. And my main point was to get back in the saddle in terms of the culture change that we've been working on. And I get one more pay raise at the end of this year, and I'm going to lean as far as I responsibly can on the high side once again. By the way the bell curve works, if the average pay raise is 3, somebody's getting 8. Or some, you know, something that, because somebody's getting 0 down at the non-performing tail. And, but yeah, we have worked on that, and I believe that from everything we can tell, Indiana employees, of course there's a spread, but are that the morale is better and that they're proud of what they're doing, and I can certainly tell you departments in which they're very proud.
Were there certain steps, if you don't remember, certain steps that you as governor took to ensure that that pay-for-performance system worked correctly and that, for instance, in terms of the evaluation process?
That's a really good question. And the answer is that all we could do, really pushed on our people, because I had seen in business too, you know, this can be done with a lick and a promise. I mean, it can't, that can't be, you know, you have to have a real and hopefully candid and fair evaluation of every employee. We never did quite decree we never forced a ranking or decreed a bright line, shape to the bell curve. But we were pretty firm with people. Anybody who came back and could only identify 2 or 3 or 4% non-performers, we sent it back for more work, particularly early on. And we really did. I did ask every year for updates on the progress of evaluations.
Now, having worked in a dysfunctional bureaucracy and observed many others, where this often goes off the rails is, of course, the evaluator is from one tribe, and the evaluatee is from another tribe or whatever. And do your evaluatees, if they said, you know, I'm really a 5 and you're saying I'm a 1, what kind of redress did they have? Because that is just a huge problem. Mm-hmm. When you're, you know, you've got a system that's pretty distorted and you're trying to move to that, what you're talking about.
Right. Well, there are, you know, we have a centralized, we centralized a lot of things, which may sound counterintuitive to you, but there are certain...
No, the next question I have is...
There are certain things.
Power,
yeah, well, that's right. And so personnel was one, and so they can appeal. I don't hear about a lot of it happening.
Yeah, well, we'll find out. But
you know what I hear much more is that. And by the way, our management. Well, they did ask. Now that I think of it, we started with a 3 option. Mm-hmm. You know, acceptable, superb. Excellent,
yeah.
Not unacceptable. And I think our management asked for a 4th so that they could be a little more differentiating. And particularly since then, I have not heard about lots and lots of grousing. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but I don't think so. But yeah, there is that possibility.
See, that's why unionization is often so important to them. Is
somebody to help.
It's the only protection against the arbitrary manager.
Yeah. Well, on that point, first of all, we didn't ban unions. The union's still around somewhere. All we said was you don't have to pay them to have a job. 90-odd% opted out without any. By the way, we didn't even require them to re-up. We didn't do anything. We didn't put anything out. It was purely word of mouth and voluntary. But, you know, they can still, a few percent still do belong, and whether you belong or not, you want to take a union person to the meeting, you can, just as before. Now, we did pass civil service reform in the last General Assembly with surprisingly little attention.
Yep. Yep.
70 years since Indiana changed its law in any respect. There's still an appeals process if you feel it in any respect, evaluation, dismissal, discipline, whatever. But it's more streamlined. And now every employee is an at-will employee, except those who are paid with federal funds where it's not permitted. I don't know that. There may be other states like that, but I'm unaware of any state that has anything like that and pays for performance. So, I'm hoping that we'll have after a generation or maybe 8 years is a good start, this will be accepted as the way we do business in a fair way, and a more fair way. I mean, the world's moving this way. Look at public education. Young teachers have been penalized forever.
Yep.
Because they didn't have enough time and grade. And that's coming to an end in a lot of places, including here.
Gathering up the reins of power. So.
It's a good question, too.
Because that's the, you know.
You know, I'm remembering now some anecdotes. I had never worked in state government. So I didn't know much of anything. And while I was running, I had a meeting with, I was invited to a meeting with leaders of, let me just say, one of the heavily regulated businesses. Mm-hmm. I guess it had dawned on them that, you know, we might actually break through, and they thought they'd
better know this guy.
And so someone asked a question about some matter of policy. Well, let me just say, it was in the energy industry. And so I said, listen, Indiana ought to be producing more of its own energy. We've got to find clean, environmentally sensitive ways to use the coal we're sitting on. We're not lucky enough to have oil or natural gas in any real quantities anymore, but we do have coal. And maybe biofuels. But I said, I'll appoint members to the commission who understand that that's our policy. And you know, I started down this trail. And I noticed that, I thought I'd said something wrong. I noticed that people sat forward. And finally, one of them said, you'll give guidance to the people that... I said, well, yeah, I'll never go near an individual case, of course, ever. You know, but in terms of broad policy, this will be our policy, and it'll be reflected in everything we do, including the... But, you know, I thought, gosh, this obviously hadn't been the case. An even better example, I was talking to somebody who said that they had sought and sought and sought and sought a meeting with my predecessor. Or a predecessor. It was actually the...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not my immediate predecessor, but his. They felt they were really being bullied around and abused by a given agency. And they finally get in here. And my predecessor said, that makes a lot of sense. I'm sorry that's happened. I had no idea. But thanks for coming in. Then they go back to the agency. The agency says, we never hear from the governor's office. You know, I don't care what they told you in there. This is what we're going to do. And I said, well, you know, we're not going to operate that way. So it is obviously very important. And it's easier in the state government. I don't know what it's like. I mean, I know how difficult this would be in an incredibly entrusted federal government. I have no idea how hard it would be in Africa or some of the places you guys work. But in a typical state government, it ought to be doable. Because you can make at least enough personnel changes if you have to make the policy stick. And you can certainly try to... influence the way in which your agencies treat people and make their own decisions. So, now, in terms of the reins that you're asking about, yes, having a very empowered budget office was important. Now, there was always a budget office, but we wanted to really add to that. We built a little platoon of people there, and they've been written about, and it's pretty interesting. I mean, and they still operate today, and they have a roving portfolio. And you know, it's not all that often things they see that no one saw before. It's that they find somebody in an agency who's been trying to get something fixed or has a good idea, and then and here comes some allies. Oh, good idea, Rick. Let's go talk to your boss about that. Other three areas that I always encourage people, I say in most of life I'm a libertarian, but when it comes to IT in particular, I believe in dictatorship. So we pulled information technology, personnel, and procurement together centrally. And with really positive effects. I mean, information technology, you not only had incredible amounts of money wasted, but it was wasted to customize things everywhere in a way that so they couldn't work with each other and and you have to hire an integrator to try to make them work with each other is nonsense. So there's been one central IT here. You can't order a new anything without their clearance, and everything harmonizes. And we have that's been a positive thing. Likewise for personnel, we've been able to really manage headcount down where it's not necessary. I forget where we are now, 75, I think we're doing the fewest state employees in Indiana since 1975. It keeps backing up. And procurement in particular, you know, I was part, for a long, long time, I was part of, I consider, a very well-run corporation, but in the late 90s, we realized we were really careless about procurement. I saw huge improvements there. Well, I got here, I thought, you know, can't be any better, and it was worse. And so, yes, we called in all the credit cards and drew up master contracts for the things we spend the most on. We've got some great prices for everything. We're sharing them with local governments and schools, if they're wise enough to tell their cronies no and join us, you know. And so a degree of that is really useful.
On the other hand, one of the dilemmas of procurement is the more you want procurement officers that have the flexibility to choose best value over lowest price.
That's right. That's right.
And I'll just tell you an anecdote. Mm-hmm. European Union went to that several years ago, and they just did a study, and, you know, 99% of the decisions are lowest price because they're afraid of, you know, second guess.
It can be a risk, and I hope we've had the balance about right, but you know, procurement's just dangerous because it's too much fun.
Yeah.
You know, when everybody, and I mean the way it was here, I mean everybody, every little office had, you know, at least some authority to go buy stuff. Well, office is always filled with smiling, friendly salespeople, and you know your jokes are all hilarious, and you know, how about you go out to lunch, and it's just fun, and so and it's not your money, so
more fun.
There got to be a better way than that.
When you came in, and you had these 70 odd agencies, of which 15 or so are sort of central to the guts of the government. Did you know on day one who you were going to appoint? Had you, by the end of the transition, identified?
We were pretty close. Yes, but it's a scary thing. It was a boon, but also a worry that we had been in the wilderness 16 years. There were no veterans. Long term, that was good. Nobody brought bad habits with them. Or too constrained a view of what should be possible. But, yes, I've reminisced often that after a long day out rattling around, you know, usually be some evening speech somewhere, I'd get all fired up. I'd say, I just know if the people of change can break through, that citizens of unprecedented idealism and talent will step forward and help us grab this state by the lapels and shake it, you know, that sort of thing. Then I'd walk out in the dark to that RV thinking, loudmouth, who are you talking about? You know, how do you know that? What if nobody wants these jobs? In the end, we were very, very fortunate. And yes, I don't remember that we certainly hadn't spoken to anybody about it. It wouldn't have been appropriate, but I don't remember having anybody really firmly in mind on election night. But we went right to it after that, and we were very fortunate because a lot of really first-class people. I raided my old employer. There were some people taking early retirement in various places. We found a couple people, a guy who was running a major sporting goods company, and they got sold. He was, you know, in between. He's off doing religious mission work most of his time now, but he was willing to give a little time.
And when you say we, who comprised your sort of core team during this transition period?
I formed a little transition team, but it was a handful of my most trusted friends and advisors, I guess. But we had, you know, a lot of folks were really eager to help. And the transition teams are, you have to be careful because a lot of people want to be in them because they have a motive beyond that. So we try to factor for that. And if people had a profession that related to this or that corner of the government, we said, we'd love to have you. And you work over here in a different quarter, you know. We didn't want somebody designing and picking it. But anyway, we had some really good people who went in and, again, we didn't know too much. We hadn't exactly been had information shared with us by our opponents, and no idea, really, nobody did, how deep the fiscal hole was. But anyway, within about a month, so well ahead of inauguration, had some really good insights and briefings about the kind of problems, which helped us figure out the kind of people we'd want in this job or that job. But it's hard to remember at this remove, but I remember it basically being a matter of identifying people. Well, first find the 11 best athletes. Then we'll figure out who's a linebacker and who's a cornerback. And really, really good people said, I'm at a moment, or I feel called, or you know, something, for some reason, I'm willing to do this. In almost every case, for less money and you know, more stress and all that business, which is just what you want. I had people say, I'll work for nothing for 2 years. I mean, there was a real sense, if you could get the, wind the tape back to there, there was a real sense of excitement. I remember how often that word came up. People said, everyone I talked to says they're excited. And I think it's because there was a very pervasive sense that the state should be doing much better, and hey, here's something new. So, my best recollection is that that people just began popping up, and I would recruit people first.
Yeah.
But Rick, darn it, you've been complaining about these things for a long time. This is your chance. I know it may not be the most convenient thing, you know, and so I was recruiting people, and as people fell for it, then we're going, okay, now, you know, how would Messick fit it in that, you know? Maybe that's not it. Maybe Messick ought to run an idea, you know, be like that.
Now, the one thing, though, is you bring people with non-government experience, no background.
Yeah.
And, of course, what you often see in this country and other countries is then the career bureaucracy, and often it's not that they deliberately undermine you, but, oh, that banana peel he's about ready to step on, well, we'll just let him step on it. And how did they avoid that?
Well, sometimes they didn't.
Sometimes they stepped on it.
Sometimes they did. But, you're going to be able to interview some of these people, right? Those are great questions to ask them. They'll have specific examples that I either never heard or forgot. But I think most of our people, the people we picked have been successful leaders of organizations of some kind, sometimes nonprofit, but anyway. And they were, as a rule, humble enough to know what they didn't know, savvy enough to know that they better win over some people, or if they couldn't, then find a way to replace them. But again, I would say, and I don't think it's I don't think I'm putting a gloss on things, that in many, many places, state employees were interested to do better. I mean, if you worked in our Bureau of Motor Vehicles, you were probably a little tired of those jokes and worse than jokes, you know, the hostility of people who sat around for 2 or 3 hours. And so with many other places.
Something that everyone from heads of state to local mayors to people in the private sector faces is just the daily challenge of how do you manage your schedule? Particularly in a situation when you come to office early on and you have a long list of priorities.
Yeah.
And it's at once prioritizing, but then deciding in a limited number of hours in the day, how do you get done what you need to get done and not have the phone constantly ringing off the hook, not be running to every agency when there's a fire. And I'm wondering if, and this is something we see with, I was recently in Liberia, and the president of Liberia has purported to have about 6 cell phones, and she's constantly working to try to clear up every issue. And granted, it's a much, much different context, but was there a strategy, is there a way that you've thought about how you, on a day-to-day basis, just set up your calendar?
Well, let's see. First of all, I did maintain direct reporting, you would say relationships, with a fairly wide span of people, probably in the 15 to 18 range, you know, the key department heads. And I still do, and they rotate through. I want them to feel a direct sense. I resisted. We finally put in place a system here that every governor had one. There are some assistants who each look over certain departments, but I don't let them monopolize our contacts. And every cabinet officer and agency head, I hope, feels they should, but, you know, they need to, and a lot of them do, just check in. But anyway, we want them to be empowered in their area. We make a big deal out of metrics and measurement, and so they know what performance they're supposed to be achieving. I think they know what the priorities of the administration are. I tell the story all the time about before anybody was sworn in, you know, the first group, I told them, here's our basic objective is to raise the net income over time of people in this state, disposable income. And we're going to, wherever you are, there's something you can do or do better or stop doing to make that outcome more likely. And so I hope, you know, some clarity of purpose, some degree of real empowerment, some degree of accountability, more tools, meaning the ability now, which is pretty much complete, to reward the best, promote the best, vice versa. Gathering the reins where that's appropriate centrally, that we talked about. Somewhere in there, I think, has been our MO now. I never carried more than one cell phone. In this job, particularly as I've chosen to do it, a big question of time is simply the division of time between being here and being somewhere else, principally out in the state. I had made such a established such a pattern of going everywhere, going to all the places that, quote, nobody ever comes here. And I was very intent on preserving that brand, if you will. So there's a seasonality, of course, when we don't have a year-round legislature, which is helpful. So it meets roughly 5 months in the odd year and about two to two and a half in the so-called short term. That was also an interesting thing. You know, we got down to the first term, the first session, some of the legislators said, wow, my gosh, you know. They said, well, we got a year to catch up. What are we talking about? Well, we don't do much in the short session. You know, the budget's done. We don't really have to do anything. I said, what do you mean? I said, we don't have a week to waste, let alone a session. So every one of our short sessions, some of the biggest things we've done happened in the short session. When historically, sometimes they really did almost nothing. But our transportation breakthrough happened in the...
Oh, in the short session?
That was my answer to that question I mentioned. What's next? And I said, it has to be infrastructure. Don't ask me how we're going to do this, but we've got... I think we've just put the state on a path to cure its operational deficit and pay back its debts. It's going to take, two or three years to get there. But meanwhile, we've got this, think of it as a capital deficit, like every state basically, that they say is maybe $3 billion, frankly, it's probably more than that. But and so I said that, and so yes, the that was a 2006 item. And 2008 was property tax reform, the biggest, my biggest
short
tax
session.
Reform. Short session. 2012 was right to work.
Now, you made it a point that, gee, you guys hadn't run on this, and now you come out of nowhere.
Well, I wouldn't say nowhere,
but
that's a fair point. Had not run on it. When asked, it said Indiana. I think Indiana can advance economically with the labor laws we have. Let's just not have that argument. But I was very open, and I started saying a year ahead of time. You remember in 11, maybe this is what you meant. In 2011, there were a lot of legislators newly elected who wanted to bring it up. I said, wait a minute.
Oh, yes.
Didn't run on it.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Not, I didn't, but you know, you did. You just got elected, but you didn't run on it. And that's not the way we ought to do this. And besides, it could jeopardize other things that, 11 was education reform and another big budget and so forth. But we did use 11 to explore it in great detail, and I was, the case was becoming more and more compelling to me that we were just missing too many opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
We had 7 years of experience by then. We were missing a lot of opportunities for lack of the law, but otherwise jobs that would come to this state. Not to mention, we had a roaring recession still going on, and we just needed every edge we could get. So by the time 2012 got here, I didn't think it was fair anymore for people to say, oh, it's a
surprise.
Sudden surprise or something. But the point, that's the short session thing. You know, back to the whole idea of moving fast, my whole bias I've tried to inculcate in all our people is always fast, fast, fast. You know, one of my many little by now cliches, let's operate at the speed of business, not the speed of government. And that just spills over into everything. I mean, moving targets are harder to hit. So we've always tried to define the agenda and have people responding to our suggestions, and sometimes they approve them, but in any event, we've tried to force the action. Now, a really good example, I think, where that intuition served us well, was the major moves, total release. So, after we really looked at this hard, it was clear to me there was no way. We had I remember they had racked up 30 plus options. I said, I'm aware of this, go out and find any way that somebody has tried to gather up additional infrastructure dollars. And stuff, raise the gas tax, inflate their index the gas tax, special fees for this, special fees for that, all kinds of things. So you do the numbers, you add up the first 30, and it's not, you're not in the ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you could, in your imagination, quadruple the gas tax. So the only thing that might work was what we finally did. And we had no idea we'd get a bid as big as we got.
That was amazing.
It was really three times a reasonable valuation of the road in state hands and an optimistic valuation of the road in state hands. So anyway, the culture of the place, and a lot of people said, oh, very interesting, but oh, I don't know, there's... Maybe we should, let's have a study committee, let's wait a year. And first of all, my business instinct said, this deal's never getting any better.
Right.
Either the bidder's going to get cold feet, or the market's going to change, both of which would have happened. And second, 2010's an election year, and that fragile majority could go away. And if it, which it did.
Yeah.
If we had waited, it wouldn't have mattered if they bid $40 billion. Our partisan opposition would not have permitted it. They wanted to continue a patronage operation. They certainly didn't want us building roads and doing this stuff. You know, the public be damned. They didn't like the partisan implications of that. So, thank goodness we pressed ahead, and it was, oh man, it was a mess, but we made it. And there's something, you know, there are things you worry about. This culture we've tried to build could be undone easily. You know, the better business climate, we're now right there at the top of everybody's list. Wouldn't be too hard to tear that down. A couple years of tax increases and hostility to business, you know, a different regime could turn that around pretty fast. Our education reforms, you know, that all we've done is pass the best laws in the country. Mm-hmm. They've got to be implemented. Mm-hmm. Things are working and moving in the right direction, but that's a very durable establishment. Mm-hmm. But there are certain things, like property taxes, constitutionalized.
Yeah.
And we are done doing that. The roads we built are going to be there for generations. The parkland, I mean, the wetlands and other things we're conserving, mm-hmm. I don't think anybody's going to undo that. So, but some of the most important stuff, you just have to hope it can be culturally embedded in a way that makes it hard to reverse.
And do you see, like, see the thing we tried to build in?
Let me just make one more thing. You probably noticed this because you've obviously done the homework. In the civil service reform that I mentioned in the past, we prohibited forced collective bargaining.
Yes, it would take a statute. Yes.
You couldn't do it again the way it was done.
Mm-hmm. With buys.
But what we try to advise people is implementation of things like education reform, etc., multi-year, etc. Mm-hmm. So let's find an outside interest group with continuing interest in monitoring and jumping up and down and making sure that, you know, the I's remain dotted and the T's crossed. Do you have anything like that in education?
No. Eventually we got some. But it's a very good idea. And it's something we have never been very good at here. We always were working for third, I always talk about third party authority and all that, certainly allied groups. We did pretty well. As close as we came was in the education area, where we helped people raise a lot of money, and we were able to carry the message to people, without filtration by
other
resistors of change or the media. Right to Work, we did the same. Mm-hmm. I was the face of both of those. Not entirely, you know. Young teachers were prominent in our advocacy of tenure reform. Mm-hmm. You know, the young teacher said, "I got the best in town award, and I'm the one they're going to
fire first."
But it's a really good suggestion, but. It's something I wish we had been more successful at. Property tax reform, we had a pretty good outside group. But you're really talking about a watchdog group after.
Yeah, because, you know, and the problem we face in the United States is, the best watchdog, I always say, is the opposition party.
Right, right.
And, of course, you have weak opposition, and so you try to create these civic action groups, et cetera. The skills, the interests, the time available is always questionable.
You know, the staying power.
Yeah, exactly.
It's easy to organize a group, you know, to go get something.
Right.
But to organize a group to keep people from getting that which they should not have.
Or watching people build a road and making sure that the gravel is up to specs.
Oh.
As we try to do in the Philippines.
Interesting.
And have somebody come out and take a picture when the dump truck dumps and then send it to somebody who's knowledgeable enough to say that gravel does or doesn't meet spec. And it's a hope. We'll see if it implements. You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's not just a third world problem.
I believe I've written on this myself.
One last question, and we should let you go. Okay, you've been a business executive, and now you've been a government executive. And, you know, we always, of course, hear, well, we'll bring the skills of business to government, but yeah. Where do those fall short? Where is it different?
Yeah, well, obviously you have to first understand, and second, accept the shared governance, you know, the rightful role of the legislature, first and foremost. And early on, somebody said something about, it wasn't relationship management. You asked something in that area, and that's a very important one. And some of our people just didn't understand. The best example was Joel Silverman. I mentioned that was he was the sporting goods executive. Mm-hmm. So he was, from a business standpoint, he was really pretty ideal for Bureau of Motor Vehicles. He'd been in the retail business.
Yep.
That's what that was. Mm-hmm. It was a customer service. Mm-hmm. So one of our transition guys said it's 174 Dairy Queens.
So yeah.
Yeah. Cash transactions, mm-hmm. walk-in business, customer service. Well, so things that were perfectly obvious to Joel and were correct, you know, needed to be done with some care, like closing a bunch of branches. And he came to grief just because he's a very nice person. I don't think anybody ever said he wasn't, but he was. Eventually, he would get blunt at these meetings. Some legislatures, you know, a legislator is posturing, showing off for his constituents. You have to understand that's what they do. You know, let them. But Joel, you know, if he said something really idiotic, Joel would tell him, you know, that doesn't make any sense at all, right in front of his constituent. So there's, you know, a sort of example where rationality can't be the only.
Mm-hmm.
Objective or criterion. But you know, most of our people adapted pretty well. As we talked about earlier, they understood that the best of them understood you're not going to fix things by ordering people around. You're going to get them and you're going to enlist them
to run
in a change that's going to make us all look better. It's going to make us all perform, the whole operation perform better. They're good and bad managers in business.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you get a good business leader, most of it comes naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who's going to fail would eventually, I think, have run into trouble trying to make another enterprise work well, just loosely speaking. You know, they just had, you know, you'll get a better sense when you talk to some of them, but they had to find those people in their organizations who were prepared to be results-oriented, not process-oriented, not play it safe. You know, I outlined a book and sort of gets into a lot of these things we're talking about here, and I don't think I'm ever going to have time to do it. And I asked a couple guys to go get me a bunch of examples, you know, interviews with people, and they both let me down, so I don't have them. But the working title was The Last Monopoly, and the point was that the working title would have been something like The Last Monopoly, Why Government Can't Shoot Straight and How to Improve Its Aim. And what I added was, it's been long, months and months and months ago, I would look at that, and if there's anything in there we haven't covered, I'll send you a message. But
university presidents have lots of time on their hands to write books.
Let's see. One thing I got to do, I got to get somebody to help me. figure out. I don't know how exactly you organize to teach a class. I think I want to teach a class.
Well, that was going to be my one suggestion.
What should I be teaching anybody? But it might be in this area we're discussing.
Exactly what we talked about. I assume there's some sort of management or...
Yeah, school management. Yeah, I was sort of thinking
should definitely do that. Because then you'll know the kind of job. You know, you're going to oversee a bunch of people who do this for a living, and having a sense of what they do is...
Yeah, I just have to figure out what you assign somebody to read.
I'll send you some suggestions if you want. I taught a course where I had a lot of stuff like this.
And what you're working on here...
Yeah, exactly.
If you got... No, that'd be real helpful. Yeah. If you could... You know, I actually could... Sure, I could bring in some of the people you're going to interview, and mm-hmm. a little of that's probably a good idea. It gives them, you know, that real world character. But that's the lazy man's way to do it. I don't really want to do that. There's got to be.
Jim Wilson has a book on bureaucracy.
Yes.
If you have not read, you will read it, and you'll realize how much you absorbed or intuited or discovered that he
wrote. I've read a lot of his stuff, but I don't think I've read that.
That book is unbelievable.
And with our case studies, we actually one of the uses is not only for reform leaders to be able to read it, but to be able to put them into the hands of lecturers
and practitioners to say,
hey, guys, here's how...
Some of your case studies might be perfect reading assignments. Would you do that? Cook up a little bibliography possibility of the sorts of things, because it wouldn't, you know, it would be a year from this fall, mm-hmm. be the soonest. I gotta have so much to learn. But it is something I think I ought to do, and I probably would like doing. And that's, you know, I can make up all kinds of things you can, of course, ideas, but that's the one I think would be the most value added. It's why your center's important, because as I preach all the time, you know, the world's full of people who are prepared to argue for this size government or this size government, you know, the philosophy and the fiscal, okay, fine. At some point, a given polity decides. And now the question is that nobody seems to want to talk about it. How the hell do you make it work? Like, our conservative brethren and I stop, too often they just stop at, okay, we cut it back. Well, bully for you, but you know, you got just as important a duty to spend it well, plus as you did to not spend more gross dollars than you should. And that's the hard thing. That's why your work is important. And then, you know, by my lights at least, we want people to have more confidence in government. Skepticism, yes. Contempt, no. My little slideshow I sometimes show, I had it up here in Boone County yesterday. Toward the end, there's a survey that was done by, I don't know, commissioned by the Manhattan Institute last year. 77%, 77 to 16. When they surveyed Indiana citizens, said their state government was efficient. It was the highest in the country.
77?
77. Illinois was 29, for instance.
That's because
the national average was 40-something.
79% of Illinois citizens are on the state payroll.
That's
they got that high.
77%. Only his state was higher was Montana. And I said, you know, what is that? I don't even know what government does in Montana. So I considered that one of the most important data points of all those that have accumulated in these 8 years. Not just there's so much as an affirmation of what we've done, but it's a good thing if people believe that the government is operating on their behalf and is doing a halfway good job of it. And I always said to our people, you know, results matter, we have to deliver them. And if we do, and people will listen in a change-resistant state, will listen a little more openly to the next new idea.
Governor, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, of course.